So welcome all you early birds. How many of you currently teach either part-time or full-time? How many of you teach 8 o'clock classes? Okay.
I swore I would refuse to graduate if it required 8 o'clock class.
We appreciate you coming. When we came up with the idea for the panel, we didn't have any request in for a time slot, so Jay gave us this breakfast spot. We were really not competing against anybody except people who are sleeping or eating. So in case, my name is Eric Friedman. I'm the director of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at Michigan State. And my panelists have all made the transition, some, within the last 3 or 4 weeks, from full-time professional to academia. And we expect that this trend of journalists looking for more security after the insecurity of their current media situations will lead to looking at university opportunities, community college opportunities. But also, since we've all got extensive professional experience, we believe that starting out, going in as an adjunct, teaching a course a year or a course every so often is a good way to see whether it's a good fit for you, and also to bring that professional experience to the classroom. So, this is going to be our format. Each speaker will talk for no more than 8 minutes, and I'm ruthless about that. A little bit about their background, how and why they made the transition, and one or two pieces of advice or lessons they learned the hard way. And then the rest of the time will be question and answer. And I've also given out, except for those who came in late, a paper that we did for the COSI conference on, based on interviews with journalists on how they made that transition. You're not obligated to read the paper, but it's there.
Homework.
Yeah, there'll be a quiz, but there's some best practices at the end. And the other authors are Bruno Takahashi, who was here someplace doing focus groups, and Mark Nugel from University of St. Thomas, who decided to go to Prague for his Fulbright instead of Pittsburgh for the SEJ conference. So, any case, I'm going to start with Randy Loftus, who is sitting next to me. Randy is a lecturer at the University of North Texas and formerly longtime reporter at the Dallas Morning News. So you have 8 minutes, and I'll cut you off.
Okay. If I don't use all my time, I'll sell the remainder. Thank you. I'm in my first semester as a full-time faculty member at the Mayborn School of Journalism at the University of North Texas. UNT is a state school, about 38,000 students in Denton, which is 40 miles north of downtown Dallas. Mayborn School has existed as an independent school for about 3 years now. Prior to that, it was a department of the College of Arts and Sciences, which itself has now been busted up into a couple of smaller units. I spent 26 years as the environmental writer at the Dallas Morning News. Before that, I did the same thing for 8 years at the Miami Herald, and before that, a few years at a small paper in South Carolina. I had been adjuncting at UNT for some time, teaching basic journalism and writing classes, and occasionally something that was a little bit more fun. History of U.S. media is one of the things I've taught several times, and I'm teaching again next semester. The 2015, I took a buyout from the Dallas Morning News, spent a couple of years freelancing, and I'm still doing that, but when the opportunity came up to join the faculty at UNT, I applied and was selected after what could not possibly have been a rigorous screening process, because they hired me. The students are largely local, although we do get a good many national and international students. We have a heavy contingent of transfer students from community colleges, which I myself was a community college kid long, long ago at the, before going to the University of Georgia. The challenge with that is that they have not had the same courses as they would have had in the first couple of years at the university. But the advantage of that is they are frequently better prepared emotionally for the journey of college. As a lecturer, I am non-tenure track. People have asked me, gee, aren't you worried about that? And I say, no, because no job I've ever had has had tenure, and I haven't gotten fired yet. I did get fired as a dishwasher when I was in high school, but I richly deserved it. The other aspect of being a non-tenure lecturer is that I teach four sections instead of three, but I don't have a research requirement, although it is encouraged, it is not required. So I don't have to worry about that so much. And the continued freelancing that I do also counts a great deal toward faculty reviews. That's they like that a whole lot. There's a great desire to get into publication. So that's worked out quite well. The one thing that I have found in the transition is that it's not quite as hard as I thought it was going to be. Having taught as an adjunct for a long time, for relatively low pay, et cetera, and now I'm being a full-timer at relatively low pay, the transition's actually been quite pleasant. Part of that is because I'm on three faculty committees and none of them has met yet. So that's my kind of a committee. I hope we can maintain that record. I would say that if you're thinking about doing something like going full-time, consider that it's a culture change. Within my experience anyway, university faculty is not a newsroom, doesn't quite have the same yelling and throwing things across the room and screaming and swearing because there's simply not that much opportunity to have to do that. At the same time, I'm sure that after a few committee meetings, I might be closer to that myself. But in terms of curriculum, I'm free. Once I get a class, I'm free to write it myself. We don't have a whole lot of rules about that. We have a few core journalism classes that we try to maintain the same kind of content throughout all the sections, but still I have a great deal of freedom. I'm not handed a template. And for some people, that can be a challenge because you really are making it up, but you can also rely on peers, and there's lots of syllabi available on the internet. I've done a lot of consulting with other people who teach similar classes to the ones I have. My course load this semester is two sections of public affairs reporting, which is government reporting, which I've taught many times. So, and it's two sections, so that a little tip, if you have to teach four, get two of them to be the same class twice, and you've got three preps instead of four. That's a pro tip. The other class that I've taught many times before is opinion writing, so I'm already prepared for that. The one that I'm really having the most fun this semester with is music criticism. Saw that on the syllabus, on the schedule. Nobody was assigned to teach it, and I said, I'll do that. UNT has one of the world's elite music colleges, so we have lots of resources for that. So if you have a chance to do something that's a little bit offbeat and maybe a little bit more challenging, I encourage that as well, because I've gotten a lot of enjoyment out of doing that. Keeping up with grading, returning papers on time is pretty important. It's part of the bargain you make with students, but it's also part of your review process. When you're a lecturer, your annual review depends a whole lot on how well you teach, because that's your primary function in the school. So they really want a good teacher, So I work very hard on that. I change up all the time, trying new things, trying to maintain some kind of diversity in their experiences. I would say the one thing that I've adopted more than anything else is team teaching. There's all kinds of training available for doing that. There's different ways of doing it. But anything you can do to engage the students so that they are learning on their own instead of being taught is a very good thing. All the research shows that it soaks in better. Frankly, it takes a little bit off the pressure of you of having to prepare 3 hours of lecture a week. Nobody really enjoys doing that, or certainly they don't enjoy hearing it either. So anything you can do to shake things up and maybe alter their expectations a little bit is probably a good thing.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Sarah Shipley Hiles, sitting next to me. She is an assistant professor at the School of Journalism at the University of Missouri.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming out so early. So my story is a little bit different in that I'm actually in my 11th year of teaching. Hard to believe. But I started out as a newspaper reporter and did that for 12 years and really wasn't thinking whatsoever of going into teaching during that time. And then life circumstances changed and I decided to become a full-time freelancer, which I did for a couple of years. And I decided that wasn't suiting me too well. It was didn't really kind of suit the type of stories that I wanted to work on, which was more kind of in-depth project work. And so I was working part-time at another job to kind of make ends meet and bring in more money. And I thought, you know what, let me give this teaching thing a try. So I took my first adjunct job. At the time, I was living in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And so I got a one-semester teaching gig at the Western Kentucky University. And as it turned out, I really loved it. Just fell in love with it. I thought, this is great. And after a semester of doing that, I thought, you know, a little light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, you know what? I think this could maybe be a good move for me. So at that time, I did not have a master's degree. So I decided that I really needed that because to get hired to teach without a master's degree is not impossible, but it's pretty challenging. At the time, I thought maybe I might even need a PhD, which I ultimately decided that I didn't. But I think that is particular to the circumstances and the place that you were looking to teach at. So because I couldn't move at the time, I decided to do an online master's program through the University of Missouri, where I would later end up teaching, but that was a coincidence. So they have an online master's program that was very good. I do recommend it, and not just because I work there, but it's geared for working professionals. So the nice thing is all the your fellow students are people who have interesting careers and a lot to say, a lot to contribute. And it's an online program where you are only going to campus two times over the course of your degree. So that was interesting and worked out very well for me and allowed me to kind of begin to dabble in research, which was something that I hadn't really done from an academic perspective. My research project was looking at objectivity and how journalists cover climate change. So that gave me a chance to explore something that had kind of bugged me when I was a journalist at the time, back in the mid-2000s when one of my editors insisted that I quote certain people in my climate change stories. And of course later, a little bit later, we all realized that, you know, we had completely been had by, you know, certain industries that were promoting these false views about climate change. But it just gave me an opportunity to learn what academic research was and to be able to do that. So that became a little interesting part of my life that hadn't been there before. And as I continued teaching, I was teaching adjunct at the time. And I don't know about all of you who have taught adjunct, but it's basically a volunteer job. At the time, I was being paid $1,500 per class per semester. Yeah, and some places will pay up to maybe five, but I would say probably three or even four is maybe a little bit more common. So it is really not good money at all to adjunct, but people often do it to kind of get a foot in the door or to try it out or maybe just to do something a little bit different or to have a, you know, different kind of element in your life. So after doing that for a while, you know, I quickly realized what I really need to do here is to finish this degree and you know, because I was freelancing, I was teaching part-time, and I was working on my master's degree. So I quickly as I could, wanted to move into a full-time teaching position. And I was able to get hired at Bowling Green State University and the other Bowling Green in Ohio. And I had a full-time teaching gig there. And that was, for me, also a non-tenure-track position. I was teaching four classes per semester, and that was really my job, was to teach. So that plunged me, you know, deeply into becoming a full-time teacher. And I would say that teaching is not just being a journalist in the classroom, it is its own profession. And it was a little bit shocking to me when I started that, you know, unlike teaching elementary school or high school, where you have to have an actual degree in teaching and you have to prove that you are able to teach. And there's pedagogy and all kinds of things that you study about how to convey information to students and what works best for them. That doesn't really happen at the college level. It's kind of assumed that, you know, you're a subject matter expert and that you will somehow be able to, you know, bring your students along on this journey. And it's quite a bit more complicated than that. I think over time, especially for me, I've realized how much there is to teaching and how much you can study that and become an expert at it. So that's kind of my current challenge, you know, now that I'm a decade into teaching, is how can I become a better teacher? So that's the current thing that I'm working on. And I've been to conferences and I've done a lot of reading about that. There's all kinds of stuff that you will learn about if you get into teaching, like a flipped classroom, which means, you know, instead of lecturing students during class, you record something for them to watch at home, and then when they get into the classroom, you're doing exercises. So there are all kinds of trends within teaching and things that, at least at my university, I'm expected to keep up with. So I had that first full-time teaching job for 2 years and then moved to the University of Missouri, which we not so humbly say is the oldest and best school of journalism. I know all my fellow panelists will disagree with that, but we are at least the oldest.
Well, you're old.
Yeah, we're old. But we're a really big school, and so at my university, we're like 10% of campus, and we have a lot of sway because of that, which is really nice. But we also, being very big, gives us advantages and I think maybe some disadvantages. Because we're well known, we have the students who apply and who get in are very high testing, high performing students. So the nice thing is all my students are very motivated and dedicated, but they're also super type A, high strung people as a group, you know, really competitive and all of that. So, and I'm that way too. So, you know, there we all are together and I'm trying to keep them from freaking out. So dealing with their mental health crises has become, you know, a bigger part of my job. I spend quite a bit of time counseling them, you know, talking with them, kind of bringing them along. It's not because they're not dedicated. It's because, and I'm sure my fellow panelists would agree with this, if you spend much time in the classroom, increasingly we are involved with our students' mental health needs. So that's kind of a different aspect I hadn't really expected. But also we have a undergrad, master's, and PhD program. And so I work with students at all different levels. There's tons of research going on. We have semi-professional newsrooms that all of our students work in. And I'm attached to Vox magazine, not that Vox, but we were there first. But it's a weekly magazine that comes out in print. And of course, I'm the digital director. So I oversee the website, social media, audience engagement, analytics, email newsletter, all that stuff. So I'm still doing that. And then I'm also teaching. And there is a bit of freedom in what I can teach, but not always. So I think it depends. Like right now I teach a class that is highly, highly, highly structured because it's a multi-section class. And there's really not much freedom in terms of what I do in there. But certain other classes I do have a lot of choice in terms of how I structure it. So ultimately I think the key is that it's just going to vary. It's going to vary from school to school. Whether you need a PhD or don't, whether you're on the tenure track or you're not, I'm not, how much freedom you have, what your course load is going to be, if you're expected to freelance, I'm not, if you're expected to publish research, I'm really not, but when I do those things, it does help with my review. So it's just highly, highly variable, I think.
Thank you. Our third speaker is Dave Polson. He's the Senior Associate Director of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at MSU, and he's also our academic representative on the SEJ board.
Well, good morning. I've been doing this for a while now, so it's not a recent transition. I've been teaching, I think, 13 years. Before that, I was a journalist for 22 years, so I kind of made the switch, you know, right at the beginning of the journalistic implosion. I'd like to think that I was prescient about that, but I don't think that's particularly the case. Eric asked us to talk a little bit about our motivation for getting into academia, and I guess I have to confess, for my motivation has always been to avoid that. I grew up in a family of teachers, parents, siblings, aunts, uncles. The one thing I was convinced growing up was that I would never be a teacher, so I find myself quite surprised to be where I'm at. And it's probably this organization that kind of got me down that trail. I organized a couple of regional SEJ workshops at which I brought in speakers, but I also spoke myself, and next thing I know I was speaking at the national conference and serving on panels. And then, you know, kind of got in through the side door. It'd be like a guest lecturer at somebody's journalism class, somebody that was a friend of mine and was looking to fill in a course period. A real great opportunity that happened to me was the university near where I was working had a series of one-credit journalism classes that lasted 5 weeks long, and they were always looking for ideas for filling those. And so I volunteered to do a five-week course, not on environmental journalism, but on covering land use, because I had been covering land use an awful lot and was convinced that that was kind of the fundamental journalistic issue and really wanted to get into that. And, of course, you know, as a journalist, I had all kinds of background and knowledge of people who I could bring in to help teach that class. The big thing was, is what I was worried about was I had a day job. It was very deadline-y. News would break late in the afternoon, and I had to go teach a class at night. What was I going to do if that happened? And, you know, I don't know what I would have done. It just didn't. I got lucky. You know, I sweated through that a couple of times and found out that I kind of liked it. And the journalism school director said that, oh, they had a night class for a full semester. Would you like to give that a try? And so I did that. Next thing I know, I was teaching nights, one class a semester. And then, you know, it was just simply opportunity. The Knight Center was expanding. It had a little bit of soft money to hire an assistant director. And it looked intriguing to me. Totally irresponsible decision to go that way. It was 3 years soft money. At the end of 3 years, I was without a job. But the thought was, well, you know, if this works out, maybe we can find some money to keep you on. Okay. And so I took the plunge, and looking back on it, it was a really stupid thing to do. But it worked out. It worked out. And I got hired on with a little more security as the center began to expand. So that was just, you know, taking advantage of an opportunity that happened to be available to me. So in terms of tips, a couple things occur to me that have been helpful for me is when you make the transition to academia, keep working, keep doing journalism. It's really good. It keeps you sharp. It keeps you aware of what's going on. And I think there's something to be said about modeling for our students. I think it brings us credibility if they can see that we're in there slugging away and, you know, whether you're writing a book or you're continuing to freelance or, you know, you got a part-time gig somewhere else. I do think that's real important. And I think it's easy to lose our edge, to lose our skills a little bit, and I think it's really good to practice them. And again, I think it builds us credibility with our students. The other thing I would suggest is to work hard. And it's really easy not to, okay? So academia is kind of a really strange place to be. And it's really struck home to me because I was talking to my daughter a couple months ago, and she worked as a struggling writer for many years and went back to school and reinvented herself as a computer programmer, went out in the world and did a lot of that work. She worked for Kickstarter. She worked for a bunch of other places. And now she is, of all places, working at Medill and Northwestern in their Knight Innovation Lab. And she said to me, you know, after she'd been working there for a year, she says, Dad, I work really, really hard, but, you know, I don't have to. And what a shock it was for me to go from the world into academia in terms of what the expectations are. Which is not to say that academics do not work very, very hard and are very passionate about what they do. It's just that they don't necessarily have to be. And so I would say, I begin to question myself, am I getting soft? And what can I do to keep that edge? I mean, the one thing I think that we do, that professionals do when they make that that transition is they know how to work hard. I mean, journalism is really, really hard and very, very goal-oriented. And I think you need to take advantage of having that training and transfer that over into a setting where maybe that isn't as obvious as it is in the field that you come from. The other thing that I think I've learned is meeting students where they're at. At Michigan State, we have students of all kinds of varying backgrounds and varying levels of skill. And I like to think that I can figure out where you're at and advance you and make you better. And sometimes it made us a little unfair in the classroom. You know, we should all have standards. We should all punch this ticket and everybody should reach this thing. And, you know, I don't worry so much about that. And it's a tricky thing because, you know, where it gets tricky with grading, and we all love grading. That's the most wonderful thing that we do. That's why we got into this. Okay. And what's fair, you know, to reward someone's effort and level of change versus someone who really kind of, you know, skated through and had the ability to skate through. And, come grading time, those are tough decisions for me. But I like to strive to do that at least. I've got minimal standards. You better be able to string nouns and verbs together into coherent sentences. But, beyond that, that's a little bit of a tricky thing. The other thing I would say is if you're at a college or a university, you have all kinds of opportunities there. There's really interesting people there. And so don't say no to opportunity. I found myself collaborating with faculty members on projects that I never thought I would. And the bottom line is if you are a journalist, you've got mad skills that are much in demand, okay? And there's a lot of fields that, you know, would die to have those. So I've been working, in the last couple of years, increasingly so with scientists and researchers and helping them with their communication challenges. What's interesting to me is that I begin to pull their students into my journalism classes as well. There was a guy who called me up. I had done some work with him, and some development work, and he said, Dave, we've got the research director of the International Center for the Potato coming to campus, and I think you should meet him. And I said, I don't know beans about potatoes, even less about genetics, and no, I don't have the time to meet this person. And he says, I really think you ought to meet this guy. And I said, no, I just don't have time for it. And then he guilted me into it, and I canceled my conflict, and I went to this stupid meeting. And we went around the room, and everybody introduced what they did. And this guy says, I'm really interested in narrative structure. Okay. And what the heck is this all about? And so he was all about that he ran a team of researchers who were really brilliant and could not communicate to save their lives. And it was really important for them to learn to do so, because it's really important in the funding world. Okay. And so that intersection of funding and ability to communicate, I think it's kind of a rich area for us in academia to exploit. And so long story short, I got some significant travel out of that opportunity and met some really brilliant people, and it was a lot of fun to do that thing. That said, I think it's important to be able to build the functions of journalism into non-journalism entities, things like fairness and accuracy and transparency and the ability to be concise and communicate. That said, is not journalism, and I think it's important that we don't go too far from that core mission and remember that journalism, independent journalism, is something different, and we should continue to push that field as well.
Our last panelist is Kate Shepherd. She has two titles. She's still the enterprise editor at the Huffington Post, but she's also, as of about a month ago, senior lecturer at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Media and Journalism.
Yeah, I tried to convince Eric that I shouldn't be on this panel because I've only been teaching for about 6 weeks, but it didn't work. So here I am. I didn't so much jump into teaching as stick a foot in and try to decide after the semester how the water is, and you know, take it week by week. But my weigh-in was a little bit different. So I have been a reporter for about 14 years, mostly covering the environment. I've been in Washington, D.C. for 10 years. And then I made the mistake of marrying an academic, and he got a job at UNC, and we had to move to North Carolina. So we're on our way to North Carolina. And the School of Media and Journalism was, they hired my husband, but they also needed someone to teach environmental journalism because the previous person, who was also an STJ member, was leaving. And they'd recently started a new program kind of similar to what Dave was talking about, which is it's a five-year program. It's a four-year plus one master's degree for science students who want to learn how to communicate. So they needed someone who could teach some courses in that curriculum as well. And so I had a particular skill set that they needed at the time. So they brought me on as a lecturer as well. And I didn't really want to totally leave journalism yet because honestly, it's hard for me to process not being part of a newsroom. So I am teaching part-time and keeping my full-time job right now, which has been a little bit crazy. I thought it would be okay, and then hurricane season hit, and so right like the second week of the semester, and it's been a little bit nuts, but I like that I have a foot in the classroom and a foot in the real world, and I think it's been good for my students for me to talk about like storm coverage and real world experiences with my classroom. And they wanted me to be able to do that. One of the reasons they hired me is because they wanted me to be able to work with students to get projects that we could actually publish, ideally at HuffPost or and other outlets on the web. And because I'm, you know, mostly an internet-based reporter at this point, like it's been a good experience. It'll be a good experience for the students to have a way to translate their work and publish it. So our goal is, I'm teaching environmental storytelling right now, and our goal is that eventually it'll be more of a project-based class where we're all working on building a big project together that we can publish somewhere. And that would be giving students like a cool clip and byline as well. So this semester I have environmental storytelling. The thing that's been hard for me is learning how to lecture. Unlike other people here, I really enjoy grading because to me that's like editing, which is what I do. But standing up in front of people and talking for long periods of time is not generally something I'm comfortable doing. So I've had to learn how to kind of experiment and think about the class not as a 75-minute class, but as discrete, like 15-minute segments. Like, what are we doing for this 15 minutes? What are we doing for this 15 minutes? Like, what can we do for this half an hour? So I'm not just speaking at them for really long periods of time, and that we're getting a workshop kind of environment out of it, and that the students are doing work and giving feedback in real time. And next semester, I have a little bit more of a like basic 101 kind of class. I have news writing and reporting, which will be, I think, a little bit different of an experience. Environmental storytelling, I get to really build the curriculum, which has also been a challenge because every week I'm like, oh no, what am I going to do with these students for 75 minutes? But it's been, I feel like I've really enjoyed it. It's been helpful to me just thinking about storytelling and writing from like how do I teach it to students rather than just how do I like make my reporters do it. We spend a lot of time, you know, working on scene development, talking about characters, talking about narrative arcs, and like it's not the thing you actually get time to do in a newsroom anymore. So it's really enjoyable to like take the time and step back and think about how we tell stories and why we tell stories. And so I've found it sort of uplifting as a journalist to be teaching at the same time as working in the field because I'm applying it back to the newsroom as well. I definitely think. So one other challenge for me in this class is that it's environmental storytelling, and it's a 500-level journalism class, but it's cross-listed with the environmental science program. So I have senior journalism students and several grad students who have taken journalism classes, and then I have environmental science students who've literally never taken a journalism class ever, and so I'm teaching them very basic journalism, but then also trying to make it engaging for master's-level students, that's been the biggest challenge. But it's been a really creative exchange between people who know a lot about science and people who know a lot about journalism. And so it's made the class better, but there's certainly the first week of school when I realized that half my students had never heard of the inverted pyramid, and I needed to get them from that to writing a feature by the end of the semester. That was a little bit of a rude awakening. But it's certainly made the class more creative and interactive, and the students are very smart and have really good ideas, even if they haven't been doing journalism for very long. And there's a couple of perks of being in academia. Like in the spring, I get to take 16 student reporters on an international reporting trip. We're going to do some disaster recovery and hurricane response coverage in the islands, and there's no way that I'd ever be able to take 16 reporters from my newsroom out in the field. So I get to take 16 student journalists out in the field. It's awesome. We're going to do some really cool projects. So there's just access to people and resources that you don't necessarily have in newsrooms anymore, which has really been that's an enjoyable experience. But yeah, I don't. I'm only 6 weeks in. I don't have any other deep thoughts about it, and I kind of lucked into the position, and I'm not doing it entirely full time yet. But I'm certainly enjoying it.
Because I organize this, I get to go last, so I don't have to repeat what they said, and I'll just hit on a few points that have come out of my experience. I was at Daily Newspapers, first in Albany, New York, and then now defunct Afternoon Daily, and then at the Detroit News Bureau in Lansing. I was an adjunct for about 6 years, like these people, teaching one course a year. And then I went on strike, so I had a year of full-time entrepreneurial freelancing. I continued as an adjunct, and a fixed term, which is year-to-year opening, came. The director of the journalism school said, well, this is probably only going to be here for 2 or 3 years. And I said, well, it's fine. It's better than selling apples on the street corner. The strike was continuing. And after 6 years, a tenure stream position opened. And so what were going to be 2 or 3 years is now 21 years. So inertia has been a strong force. Several pieces of advice. First of all, nobody mentioned the three best parts of full-time academia, which are June, July, and August. There's a lot of time off. We get about a month off over Christmas, New Year's, depending on your program and whether you're obligated or have the opportunity to teach in the summer. But it's a chance to work on your own professional projects, to do research, to travel. And even though you don't get paid, at least I don't get paid in the summer for not working, it's still a great perk. Second, big frustration, but I learned to deal with it as an adjunct, was that student concepts of deadline and newsroom realities of deadline are two different universes. And it takes a while to hammer into them that there's a reason the word dead is in deadline. And for them, the sanction might be a lower grade or a failing grade on an assignment. And if we're preparing them for the real world, the sanctions are much greater. International students, nobody talked about that, but at my university, there's a growing number of international students, primarily from non-English-speaking countries. And it takes a lot more time to edit them or grade them, meet with them. Often there are cultural differences that we need to be able to adjust to. There are language differences, and because we're sending them out with our stamp of approval, our degree, the expectation is when they graduate, they'll be able to perform professionally at whatever they do or go on to graduate school and succeed there. So in your time planning, when you figure you have 20 assignments to grade, some are going to end up taking longer than the others. Real-world examples, always look through your journalist lens. This semester I'm teaching an international journalism class to 23 undergraduates, mostly journalism majors. A week before the Las Vegas shooting, we had a friend of mine who's a U.S.-based correspondent for Voice of America Skype in and talk about being a foreign correspondent in the United States, because her audience is primarily in Uzbekistan and people who are Uzbek speakers around the world. So right after the shootings in Las Vegas, I put a CNN story on the screen, and then I had them talk about if they were a foreign correspondent in the United States, how would they cover this and not be duplicating what the wire services are doing. So it was the opportunity to have them think like a real-world journalist. The exercise took maybe 10 minutes, but it was a chance to connect. And the last thing is, how do you get these jobs, or at least how do you start as an adjunct? And the two best ways are to knock on doors, because I frequently hear from working journalists who are, in some cases, facing layoffs or downsizing. Are there any opportunities there? And I refer them to the J School director, but I have a sense of what we might want to teach that our regular faculty, our grad students, may not want to teach. And the second is to network with existing people you know who are at journalism programs get a sense of what's going on there. Will it be hiring full-time or part-time? You have a great idea for a course. Dave talked about the land use course. We've had other people have come to us with an idea to teach a course on election coverage, for example, in an election year that was different from our existing public affairs reporting class. So they've come on sometime as an adjunct that way. And you can't just wait for somebody to call you. And you also have to be willing to drive sometimes. We have adjuncts who come in from Detroit to Grand Rapids, so they're driving hour and a half each way to come. And it's worth it for them, if not financially lucrative, at least professionally rewarding. So the rest of it is open to you for questions or for criticism or tell us your own story. Oh, tell us who you are, please. Question is, how do you do something other than lecture when you're lecturing, and we hope engages the students? So we'll pass the microphone around and start with Dave.
Randy, you got something.
Go ahead, lecture us.
Well, I don't do a lot of lecturing, although it's kind of fun from time to time to find kind of special topics that float your boat. If they float your boat, it's going to excite them. So a couple years ago, I got interested in of all things, drone journalism. Okay, and so instead of lecturing, we went out, we bought a drone, and we operated the drone, and we shot images from it, and really tried to avoid the whole lecturing thing. I think my tip, I think that one of the things that I learned the most about treating students in the classroom, and something that I have to remind myself that I often forget about, is these are not beginning journalists, and I have a tendency to treat them as beginning journalists. These are student journalists, okay? And there's a world of difference, and I think that as we as professionals, when we come in, we're going to say, we're going to teach you, and we're going to hold you accountable, and we're going to, you know, have these very high standards, and I think that's really, really good, but I think sometimes, maybe there are times when I've gone overboard on that, and that I should be a little more empathetic with some of my students, and it's not their fault if they're not at the level where I want them to be, and it's my responsibility to get them there. I think I answered your question by answering something you didn't ask, but that's...
I found that since I've got a head full of really exciting things, I should not tell the students all those things. Instead, I should help try to let them figure out how to find those things themselves. You know, the difference between teaching and learning really has gotten embedded in me. So for lecturing, there are occasionally times you simply have to convey information that they're not going to find on their own. But more often than that, I will pose a question, break them up into their teams, and tell them to go online and find the answers, and then we'll all discuss them. And I think even if it's not the same answers I would have come up with, that's going to stick with them a lot more. The whole notion of the I've heard it dismissed as the sage on the stage, where you are conveying your wisdom, and it may seem taken from a popular movie. I mean, you may remember the paper chase, where the professor intimidated his students and made them feel small. And I don't do that. You just can't do that. So I'm trying to empower them as much as possible to find their own answers. Even in the middle of a lecture, we'll stop and we'll go online and we'll find something and we will debate the answers that they found. But I think that sticks to the ribs a lot more than me telling them something, because I remember that old Far Side cartoon of the man is talking to his dog, and the dog's name is Ginger, and says, "Good girl, Ginger. Attaboy. Okay, great, Ginger. You know, get the ball, Ginger." And all the dog is hearing in his head is blah blah blah, Ginger, blah blah blah, Ginger. But I think there's a lot of that when you lecture just too much.
Why don't you start?
Sure. So I said the one thing that I've kind of learned is trying to break it up into like, we're doing this for 15 or 30 minutes, and then we're doing it for this, because otherwise it does just feel like I'm talking at them for long periods of time. The thing I've struggled with the most is I wrote the syllabus before the class started, and I really wanted it to be a class where, you know, we read really good environmental storytelling, and we watch like documentaries, and look at interactives, and then we just talk about it. And when I went to grad school, and I was in a pretty small program, there were like 11 of us, and we just couldn't shut up. We just loved talking to each other, and I thought that the class would be like that. And I had the tendency to like be like, okay, what do you guys think? Like ask these broad, open-ended questions, because that's kind of, as a journalist, you ask these open-ended questions to see what people say. And the students are just kind of like, so like having to constantly tailor how I ask the question and try to really pull things out of them has been a learning experience, because I really want it to be a discussion-based class and not me just talking at them. I have kind of had to adapt on the spot to doing more of letting them break into pairs and groups and talk amongst themselves and then come back and speak, and they're much, much better. Like they've got a chance to do it in small groups, they've come back to the table with a lot more to say. So that's been really helpful. Otherwise, I felt like I was just like having them stare at me. But I've had to do a lot of that on my feet. And a lot of what we've ended up doing is, for one, I found out that I'm really bad at estimating how long I'm going to be speaking. I had a couple days where I got through the thing I needed to say in the slides, and we still had a lot of time left. So then I'm like, oh no, what am I going to do with these students? So getting them to do some like reverse engineering of storytelling. So like we watch something and then talk about like how would you pitch that thing we just watched, or like, you know, how would you break out this into like scenes and characters, and like what's the timing of the story? And so that helps me get them engaged a little bit more by having them do specific things and look at specific parts of the story and talk about it together, and then they're like much more able to engage. But it's a huge struggle. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it takes so much time to figure out how to learn how to teach, and then each class is different. So, you know, is it set up as a lecture class where, like, you know, it's large and, you know, maybe there's dozens or even hundreds of students in there? Or is it, you know, more of a workshop type class where you've got like 8 or 10 or 15 students? That's a very different kind of dynamic. And, you know, what grade level are they? You know, what is their sophistication degree? Many things to take into consideration. If you Google flipped classroom, you know, you'll find like tons of examples and ideas on that. And like I say, I've been to a number of conferences where, you know, you're in luck, because getting away from lecturing is like in vogue right now. So that's a good thing. You know, another suggestion might be with readings. So like, I mean, reading is very important to all of us. You know, that is what we, probably why we were drawn to this profession, is because we love to read. And we assume that students are going to read the assignments that we give to them, and that is really not true. So having to figure out how to get them to read or make them read, making those readings relevant in the classroom. So it's been suggested that you should talk about the readings before you assign them and kind of give them, this is what I want you to look for, these are the things I hope you're going to get out of it, and kind of talk it up and make it sound interesting. And then there has to be some kind of feedback that they need to give you. And that often can come, some people do it through like a quiz, but it also could be more of a small group discussion where, you know, the expectation is they're going to come in and there's going to be some kind of assignment or task related to it. So breaking students into groups is good. Having instant feedback is good. If you have a large group, there's technology to facilitate with that, like the iClickers or other technology where you can ask a question and then students can either have an app on their iPhone or a device where they can click an answer so that it can pop up on the screen like, you know, here was the question and here was the group's answer. So those kind of things I think are engaging. Even playing games in the classroom. Humor is a really good tool as well, which I'm actually not very good at, so I'm trying to work on that. The element of surprise. And I try to learn a lot from watching other professors that are really good in the classroom. So we have a really quirky journalism professor whom I love, and you know, he'll bring in like bongo drums and you know just all kinds of crazy stuff to shake things up and to make it different. So I think having it be a little bit of a surprise, which is, takes more work, you know, to plan, but having them not exactly know what they're going to be getting into every single day.
Two quick points. One, and this is one of the joys of teaching environmental journalism, is that you can get out of the classroom and go places. So we're a land-grant school, and I teach the environmental journalism class. We might go to the power plant that's recently converted from partly coal to all natural gas, but it provides the electricity for the whole campus. And we do a tour there. I take them to the vet diagnostic lab where people send in their deer heads to be tested for chronic wasting disease, and farmers send in their diseased horses and so figure out why they're dying. And even in a general writing class, I'll usually send them out to do some kind of observational exercise. Go out someplace on campus by yourself during class, maybe the last half hour of class, and take notes, interview the environment is what I call it. What do you see, hear, smell, taste, touch? And then they have to write a little description of it, because I'd like them to learn some feature writing techniques, even if it's primarily a news writing class. And one other thing is, don't feel like you're locked into your syllabus. Take opportunities. So even though you've prepared this great lecture on something, an alum is coming to campus who's working for National Geographic or working for NPR or working for a PR firm. Grab those people. Give them notice, usually, if you can. But sometimes I've dragged people in when they just showed up on campus. So we had an alum who works in Alaska as a journalist. And among other things, she covers the commercial fishing industry. And she was coming back for homecoming for the first time in 50 years. And I gave her about 2 days' notice. So I just it wasn't on the syllabus. I just scrapped what was originally scheduled. And it was an opportunity. So my lecture notes aren't lost. They're there for some other time.
So just a fast, quick, and dirty non-lecture lecture that I do. We do a lesson called Study to Story, where you take a study and turn it into a story, an academic study. And it gives you an opportunity to contrast what scientists do versus what we do. You know, the lead is always buried. Forget the methods section. Make sure you go right to the discussion section, and that can help you to decide really quick if you want to bother to figure this out or not. Is there a story here or not? So I've got this short little study about Burmese pythons invading the Everglades, okay? And I got this from putting it out on the SEJ list. Or, geez, I want to do a study, the story thing. Anybody write a good story about a study? And, of course, Craig Pittman responded, okay. And he gives me this study, and he gives me a story, and it's a great story. It's really, really funny. And then I interviewed Craig, and I kept the recording. And, so how'd you come across the study? You know, why did you decide to do this? He's got a line in there that says, just like Lassie, but with scales. Okay. And everybody chuckles over that. So how'd you come up with that line? Well, you know, I came up with that line because I was describing it. I was trying to pitch the story to my editor. And I actually said this just off the top of my head. And the editor says, okay, you can do that story. You can use that line. So it's a really good example of doing that. So what I do is I give them that study. I read them. I have them plow through anything they want, tell them that they're doing it wrong, you know, go here, break up into groups, talk about how would you approach a story, what would your lead be, and I have everybody write about 3 or 4 sentences, have them do something else, compile the sentences so that I can put them up on the screen, take their names off it, talk about their leads, okay, and then I show them Craig's story, which is so professionally and hilariously written, you know, and they say, oh, I wish I could do that, which is good. You know, it is good, and I think you can do that with a number of other academic studies. Another way of doing that is recruit the person who did the study on your campus to show up as well. So not only do they read the study, they have an opportunity to interview the person who produced the study and crank out a story about it.
I'll take 10 seconds to say something really quick. The surprise factor is really important. When I teach basic news writing, their very first news writing class, I often will begin the first day by playing a song on ukulele. Usually I'll pick a slow blues arrangement of Bye Bye Blackbird that I like particularly. And then I'll make them write what they just heard. And to my benefit and to keep them objective, I'll say, you can't tell me if you liked it or not.
So. Question or comment? The question, and by the way, could you introduce yourself? Okay. The question is, given the vast changes in the industry or the industries, how do we as instructors adjust to the fact that our programs or our students may not be interested in or able to find jobs in the traditional mainstream news organizations, and how does that affect how we teach them? So I'll open that up to Sarah.
All right. I'll take that. Okay. We talk about this all the time. And, you know, I'm very frank with them, and I'm very frank also with parents who say to me, you know, my son or daughter wants to study journalism, but I don't know if that's such a good idea. And I say, well, you know what? We're going to teach them how to write, how to think critically, how to read, how to communicate in different media. So I embrace it, honestly, and I'm fine with it, because I think we're going to train people to become, you know, better citizens. They're going to be media literate. They're going to know what they're talking about. They will appreciate journalism, even if they're not practicing it kind of the old-fashioned way. And I tell my students, you know, you're probably going to change across your career. You know, look at me. I've you know, worked for magazines and newspapers. I've done PR, and now I'm teaching. You know, maybe you will start your own business. Maybe you're going to do a variety of these things, and that's good. That's fine. Maybe you're going to quit and be a stay-at-home mom. That's fine, too. So I don't really shy away from it. I encourage them to think broadly. And I also like to tell them that, you know, you are the next generation. So I would love for you guys to innovate and come up with new ways of doing things and, you know, new ways of making money in journalism. So I like to put the challenge kind of back to them as well. And it really doesn't bother me, I guess, because I do see the value in what we're doing, even if our students don't become kind of hardcore traditional journalists.
I'm going to let Kate talk because she has to leave us imminently to be the moderator for the upcoming plenary session, so she has to be on time for that.
They said they'd come pull me out if I don't leave on time. So, yeah, I think it's kind of similar. Like, I have to kind of think that I'm teaching the students how to be good storytellers, how to find facts, how to ask questions, how to be good, clear writers. I mean, what they're producing for me in the class is journalism, but I hope that those are skills that will apply to wherever they end up. My undergrad journalism program, you know, I think three of us are actually journalists, and everybody else is like, there's a doctor, a teacher, a lawyer, but I know that they're applying those skills. So I guess it's like, they're obviously not failed adults. They have cool jobs and are doing good things for the world, and they got good skills out of our journalism undergrad, so it doesn't disappoint me. And I think I just need to prepare the students for, like I said, they could be doing all kinds of different things or just using different formats to do the same kind of thing. Like, we have graduates who have, you know, they work in social media, but they're also using that to convey facts and tell stories. And, you know, they work in PR, or they work for a university as a PIO. Like, it's still the same skill set. And ideally, we're imbuing them with journalistic values that will translate. So I'm okay with it.
Another question or comment in the back?
Oh, so the question is, how much do you work with young science students as opposed to journalism students, and can you get them, trick them over the border or whatever? Yeah, the only thing to say about that is an increasingly component of what I do, and just my standalone environmental journalism class increasingly attracts non-journalism students. And it's intriguing to me because I like them because they're really bad, but they're really smart, and so they get it, and you can really see them, you know, take off, and that's kind of exciting. And it's kind of like what Sarah says. I think even if you're not training them as journalists, you're training them as news consumers, too, at the same time. I really do think there's growth potential there, primarily because at my university it's getting a little crowded, and what makes me nervous is some of these science departments and others are creating their own communications arm because they're trying to arm their students in order to be able to intelligently speak to policymakers and to the public and to media, things of that nature. And my take on that is, who better than us to do this? Get out of our backyard. You know, this is our franchise. What you should do is send your students to us rather than create your own program for doing that. You know, and part of it, frankly, you know, is a survival thing, too. You know, we have a fewer and fewer, smaller cohort. We have to be relevant, and we have to make sure that the skills and values of journalism live on somewhere, even if they're not living on in mainstream media.
From a practical salesmanship viewpoint, National Science Foundation grants have a checkbox for communicating what you found with the public. And as more universities are scrambling for more research money, that's a real gold mine for journalism programs. We need to be involved in the research efforts, if nothing else, just to train them how to check that box effectively.
We have time for one more question or comment. The question is this tension between the traditional academic research and the professional track and how institutions are responding. I can briefly tell you what we do in our journalism school, which is not consistent across the university. We've always had a mix in our faculty, whether you're fixed term or tenure stream, you are on all the same committees, you participate in all the discussions, and it's the expectations of what your teaching load and research load are that differ. And the faculty is a mix of people who are traditional academics, people who've had a little bit of professional experience, and then people like Dave and myself who have a lot of professional experience. We have people with terminal degrees. We have one colleague who is fixed term, has been there for a long time, who never went to college, but he happens to be an international authority on what he does, and he used to do it for major news organizations. It's a question of retention in part, because we have now, with our relatively new dean, created this amorphous title of professor of practice, and that's the case, I think, in Missouri and at some other institutions. So it's not tenure track, but there's job security long term. And at the same time, because we're a Research One institution, the president and provost put pressure on the deans, to put pressure on the directors and chairs, to put pressure on the individual faculty members to generate grant dollars and to generate peer-reviewed articles, even if nobody much reads them. It's an institutional culture, but there's a variety of cultures or subcultures within the departments. Yeah, but it varies tremendously, and if your provost or president changes, or your financial situation in your state, if you're a public university, changes, that might trickle down.
It varies so much by university, too. It really does. So the school that I'm at now, we have a professional practice track, and 60% of our faculty are pro practice, and 40% are tenure track. We're on three-year renewing contracts. And the last school that I was at, if you didn't have a PhD, you were a lecturer, and that was that. And your teaching load was 4-4. My teaching load now is 2-2. So it just varies so much, I think, by school and what the tradition is at that particular school. We used to grant tenure to people who didn't have PhDs some years ago, but we don't do that anymore. So, and there is an increasing, at least in my state, pressure on universities to produce their own funding. So I think, yeah, that grant funding thing has become really huge. And academic ranking, like being a member of the AAU, which is a group of more elite academic institutions, and we're a member of that. So, you know, there's pressure to produce articles and funding for that as well. More that direction, or you're expected to do that work even if you don't have a PhD?
Let me just say two quick points. One, at our university, it doesn't have to be a PhD, but a terminal degree. So it could be an MFA, it could be a JD. It doesn't even have to be relevant to journalism or what you're teaching. Second point on the, when I came in fixed term, I had no research expectations. I had a colleague across the hall who was a guru on content analysis and quantitative research, and he was interested in public affairs. I had been covering government, state government, public affairs for 20 years, and I began working with him on studies of how news media cover elections. So I kind of got into the research. He did all the number crunching because I refused to learn SPSS, but it helped when this tenure stream opening came that I had my name on journal articles and that I knew some of the research methods that social scientists know that I had not learned in undergraduate years or when I went to law school. So that opportunity to collaborate with tenured and tenure stream faculty and use your professional background is a real plus. And then the bosses notice that you're doing it too. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for coming, thank my panelists, and enjoy the rest of the conference.